Welcome back to your presidential playlist. I'm your host, Emily Tisch Sussman. For those joining us for the first time, this podcast is your definitive guide to the 2020 presidential election, explained by the women who know it best. This season, we're examining the states that will decide the election, the swing states, and how, regardless of where you live, you can make a difference. Today, we're in Florida, a state with its 29 electoral college votes that has always played a critical and often controversial role in presidential elections. In President Obama's election and re-election, he carried the state by slim margins. Experts thought that Clinton could win the state due to high support among the Latinx population, but Trump won by just slightly more than one percentage point, roughly 113,000 votes. This year, Florida is also Trump's home state after he ditched New York following the last election. Florida is, as always, in the headlines as the presidential election approaches again. The state is home to over 21 million people. Florida has a higher Black and Latinx population than the national average, and roughly a quarter of the state is over 60, above the national average, and many of them have moved to Florida, bringing their political perspectives with them. Some of the largest counties in the state tend to lean Democratic, like Miami-Dade and Broward, but even winning those counties wasn't enough for Clinton in 2016. Florida has also been hit hard by COVID. It is one of the states leading the nation's case count, with over 600,000 cases now reported. The AP recently reported that cuts to the public health sector in recent years could be contributing to this surge. In fact, although Florida's population grew by about 10% since 2010, making it the nation's third most populous state, a joint investigation by Kaiser Health News and the AP found that the state slashed its local health department staffing by about a quarter. As for the economy, between February and June, Florida lost almost 7% of its jobs, and in July, it led the nation in unemployment claims. The tourism and real estate industries are especially suffering. Politically, Florida is controlled by Republicans at every level in the state. The governor is a Trump loyalist, Republican Ron DeSantis, who was narrowly elected in 2010. Given the pandemic and the politics of the state, voters have every reason to be concerned that Floridians may not have equal access to the ballot box in November. In May, the Florida Alliance for Retired Americans, Priorities USA, and several other Democratic-leaning groups filed a federal lawsuit against Florida's governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, and all 67 county supervisors of elections to ensure more safeguards in Florida's election law so that thousands of mail-in ballots aren't thrown away in November, as happened in 2018. For a deep dive into Florida, I'm thrilled to be joined by Congresswoman Debbie Mercosell Powell. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Thank you for having me.
We're very excited to have you. Well, what's your sense on the ground? I mean, do you think that Florida will go a second time for Trump? Do you think that he'll carry your district and the state?
I think that we're at a point right now where he definitely has a very good possibility to carry my district. I know he's going to carry my district. I think he can carry the state. The reason why I'm not saying 100% is because my concern, to tell you the truth, at this point is the security of our elections. And I am not going by any of the polls. Biden is leading the president right now in the state of Florida, but none of us are looking into those polls or going by those polls. We're running my race here in the district, but also the presidential in the state of Florida, as if he's 5 points behind, and it's the way to do it. We have a huge challenge during the pandemic in making sure that everyone can vote safely. And that, of course, includes the vote by mail ballots that we have been working on, making sure that people register to vote by mail, that they receive those ballots, that they fill them out, and then that they mail them back early so that we don't have any issues with those ballots arriving after the deadline. But at the same time, we have communities that where people are struggling. They can't pay their bills. They can't put food on the table. And because of that, they're not paying attention to politics. They're worried about how they're going to get food for their family. So those people may not be able to have the time to register to vote by mail. We're going to have to reach those voters and just make sure that they have the option to vote early, to vote securely, and that they have the information that they need.
So I do want to dig in on that a little bit. I mean, are you worried about Florida pulling a Florida, you know, being the hanging Chad Florida of 2020? there's obviously concerns about election security themselves, but even just if people are going to be able to access the votes, whether it's the Postal Service not being able to respond in a timely way, or people that would generally vote in person being too concerned to show up in person and vote, and how the Board of Elections are going to reconcile the amount of people voting over a much longer period of time than they're used to having to count.
Exactly. And you know, that's a challenge not just here in Florida, but as you can imagine, it's a challenge for all of us across the country. Personally, what I have been discussing with my team and talking to the Biden team is that we need to just make sure that voters have every possible means of voting, that their right to vote is protected, and that they have options. For those people that have pre-existing conditions or other health conditions, they should not be encouraged to come out and vote in person. But for those people that are healthy, if they're wearing a mask and we have 2 weeks of early voting here in Florida, they should exercise that vote safely. So we just have to make sure that we have all options available for voters. Besides what we've seen from this governor, we have great elected officials making sure that we get out the vote and that we protect the vote.
So what does that mean in the era of pandemic to have ground game, to run like you're 5 points behind? I mean, what does that actually mean to campaign right now?
Well, it means that you have to be creative, that you have to have great people on the ground helping you. It also means that sometimes you have to go physically to deliver yard signs and to communicate with people through social distancing measures. We are the epicenter of coronavirus in Miami-Dade County in the entire state of Florida. We have more cases in the state of Florida than Italy, China, Spain combined. It's a very serious problem. It's a serious health crisis. I hope with some of the measures that we're putting in place locally, giving information to my constituents on staying at home as much as they can and following health guidelines, that by mid-October, we should be able to contain the spread and the positivity rate will be at a point where, you know, if you're following health guidelines, we can really contain the spread.
I've heard from a friend out of state who was making calls into Florida through like the Biden platform that people are so desperate for conversation that they will stay on the phone. And one thing I've never heard from phone bankers before is that she said that if she misses someone and leaves the message, they'll call her back.
Yes. People are at home. We've been at home since March. Many people have had to stay home. And, you know, unfortunately, there are a lot of people that have lost their jobs. And most of the country's forgetting. Our economy has contracted more than 30%. In Florida, more than 1 million Floridians have still not received any unemployment benefits or relief. People are desperate, and they know that. They know that this administration is not working for them. They know that Senate Republicans are not willing to pass that extension of unemployment benefits. I'm getting calls about that in my office. Those are the issues that in November, people will remember. They want someone that's going to be strong in handling this virus. And they want balance and order. You know, you hear Trump saying law and order, law and order. I think people now realize that he's the only one creating chaos. And people do want balance. They want order and they want unity. And that's something that they know I will continue to bring in my district and also Vice President Biden.
Do you think there are pieces of Biden's plan, like policy pieces, that are particularly speaking to people in your district and in Florida? Like, what do they talk to you about?
I've had conversations with the vice president, and number one, healthcare. I mean, he's someone that was next to President Obama when they passed the ACA. I have close to 100,000 people that get their healthcare through the ACA. He's going to make sure to work with the Senate and the House to lower premiums, to expand access to good quality healthcare, to provide a public option for those that want to get their public option. We have a lot of unions here, union workers that like their insurance, but it's just the premiums are becoming too costly. Someone that's going to reduce the price of medicine, that will hold pharmaceutical companies accountable, but also immigration reform. We've had several meetings with him in the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. He will provide on day one, he said it, he is going to pass the DREAMer Act. We passed that bill in the Judiciary Committee. I was very active working on that bill, and I'm very proud to say that we did it together. And the reason why we passed that bill is because we had the majority of Democrats in the House. He made the commitment that he will enact that bill into law, giving a pathway to citizenship for thousands and thousands of Dreamers in the state of Florida, but all over our country. And also the environment. I mean, in Florida, we live climate change every single day. Sea level rise is becoming a much more serious issue. He is going to put those protections back in place in the Environmental Protection Agency, and he's not going to drill off the coast. I know that he's going to also be very strong on the environment and gun violence. And you know that that's a personal issue for me.
You have said that the path to the White House in 2020 runs through Latinx voters. That is going to be the largest voting bloc. But it's been interesting, the connection between Latinx voters and vote choice, so whether it's Republican or Democratic vote choice, nowhere more interesting than in Florida. I mean, the Trump administration's earliest actions were immigration related. And when we spoke with our expert last season about white women in the suburbs who voted for Trump, and we asked her what issues really moved these white women in the suburbs against Trump, and she really named immigration and the pictures of the children in cages as the issues that moved them. But the support for Trump among Latinx voters is not zero and actually hasn't really gone down. So do you see the issues as not related? Like, how is there still higher support for him than I would have thought?
The first thing that everybody has to remember is that the Hispanic vote in South Florida, I'm talking about South Floridians specifically, there's no party loyalty. More than half of the people, like myself, I'm an immigrant, I came from Ecuador. I represent an area where half of the people that live in my district came from a different country. So they don't have party loyalty. They go by the issues. Many of them came here to work hard, to give opportunities for their children. And they are incredibly scared of anything that sounds like socialism. And the Republicans have driven that message here in Florida now for a few years. And Trump has used that message to really divide and to instill fear in the Hispanic community here in Florida. So that's one issue. But another issue that I find very interesting, and these are just more conservative Cubans, is the thought that they came here legally and everyone needs to come here legally. But, you know, a lot of the community here seems to forget that when they came, they actually were given legal status right away. So it was easier for them to be able to get a job. The Cuban community is a hardworking entrepreneurial community. They have made Miami to become what it is today, which is one of the greatest metropolitan cities in the country. It's an incredible city. But they came here and they were provided legal status pretty quickly. And so they want everyone to have that legal status. Now, the issue is that immigration has become a disaster under this administration. There's no way for people to get legal status. They're not processing asylum requests. They're not processing refugee requests. They're separating kids from their families at the border. We had a center here in my district, the Homestead Detention Facility. I was asking for that to be shut down before I even got elected. And when I got elected, I did not stop going and holding them accountable. They eventually shut it down. But that's also an issue that resonates in my area. I mean, family for us, for Latinos, Latinas, is number one. When you see images of children being separated from their mothers and from their fathers and being detained, that's an issue that we can't forget this administration did to these kids. And Republicans have never spoken against that.
Do you think there would be split ticket voters or people would potentially vote for Trump and for you?
I did have that in 2018, Emily. The only thing that I'm concerned about is that the division between the two parties has widened, I think, more under this president and after 2018. And let's be clear about something. The Trump campaign has been spreading misinformation and targeting their base and their voters for quite some time. They've been spending money here in Florida for about a year now. So when they're fed misinformation day after day after day, they believe it. So I do think that I'll still get some Trump voters because they know that I have been working for them on the environment, on healthcare. Look, Brian Mast, who's a Republican here in the state of Florida at the beginning, he didn't trust me. He didn't know me. And it took some time. And now I can say that I feel like we can work together on a lot of issues. And that's good. That's what we need to do. We need to make sure that we get things done. That's what people want from us. They want us to work for them.
What is some of the misinformation the Trump campaign's been spreading in Florida for the last year?
Let's begin with that we're all socialists, that we are radicals, that people like myself, for example, or Democrats are going to turn Florida into Venezuela. We're trying to pass the HEROES Act. We're asking the Senate to fund local, state, and city municipalities to extend the unemployment benefits, to give that $1,200 stimulus check to families that they needed so badly, and foreign interference, the vote by mail ballot misinformation that they're all doing now, that there could be fraud if people vote by mail, which is 100% false.
But do you think that it's to the point where people won't accept the results of the election because they're so dug in on this misinformation?
I am concerned that he has built, and I don't think it's the majority. You know, I think they're louder and they're more aggressive in many ways. I don't think it's the majority, but he does have a certain number of supporters. I would say maybe 30% that will rise up, that will protest, and that will not accept the election if Donald Trump isn't reelected.
What do you think we do then?
We still have our institutions in place. We still have the majority of Democrats in the House holding this administration accountable. I do believe that police departments, federal military agencies, the most important thing is to make sure that the military is independent and that they're not going to protect Donald Trump or his interest or his base. That's something that was very alarming to me to see in Portland. That's why I brought that up in the Barr hearing. We need to ensure that the military is not politicized and that they're not used as a tool to protect the president. The same with the Department of Justice. That I can't say about William Barr. I am concerned that Bill Barr will do what Trump says. And if he wants to contest the election, he will. That's one of the questions that we had for him at the hearing. And he said that he's going to follow the law. But, you know, when you're the attorney general, you say that there's fraud, then for you, that's your law. We have to be optimistic. We have to make sure that people come out and vote and that Biden wins by a large margin so that it's very difficult to contest the results of an election.
Is there anything I haven't asked you that we should cover?
I think it's important to keep in mind how diverse the Latino community is. That Mexican Americans in Texas are not the same as Mexican Americans in California or Mexican Americans in South Dade here in Florida. But that the issues that are most important to us are the same issues that are important to every American. And those are opportunities, which is why it's so important for me to continue to work in Congress protecting those opportunities. I know what it's like to come here with nothing and then to have this incredible journey in this country where I was able to get a great quality education through a scholarship. And then to be able to get a good job and work for my family and then be elected to Congress. And I think that that's what sometimes we forget in the conversation when we're trying to reach Hispanic voters. We just want to be treated fairly. We want the same opportunities as everyone else, and we need to protect those opportunities. And I think that that's one thing that Joe Biden will provide to our community, but also people like me, because I am their voice in D.C. And our voices are usually not heard, and that's why it's important to continue to elect people like me and bring more Latinos and Latinas to come and represent in Congress.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Needless to say, there is a lot going on in Florida, and no one is better at unpacking the nuances of the state than Myra Macias. Myra Macias is the executive director of the Latino Victory Fund and former political director for the Florida Democratic Party. Welcome, Myra.
Hi, Emily. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so there's a joke that Florida is the 1% state. I think there's actually a lot of jokes about Florida as the 1% state. But in this case, it's meaning that Democrats have lost big elections by slim margins. So what do you feel like activists on the ground are doing to avoid that in 2020?
Yeah, I love that more people outside of Florida now know the 1% moniker, because that has been driving the progressive movement in Florida for many cycles. And what we have found that really helps turn out Democrats is having candidates all across the ballot. So not just a focus on the presidential election or the top of the ticket, but having Democrats who speak to the values of the community running for city council, for school board, for state Senate and state House. And so it's been incredible to see how folks on the ground are actively recruiting people to run and not leave any seat unchallenged this cycle. I don't think people understand when we say every vote truly matters, that every vote really matters in a state like Florida. In 2016, Donald Trump won this state with a little over 112,000 votes. And particularly for my Latino community, we left a million votes on the table. A million Latinos that were eligible to vote in 2016 did not vote. We could have won the state of Florida. And so every vote truly matters, not just for the top of the ticket, but for down ballot races, for folks who have a direct impact on your daily life.
Florida is really a purple state. It voted for Trump in 2016, but Obama won it both times. It flips up and down. Do you think that the voters are really moderate in their beliefs and that's why it switches back and forth? Or is it more the state is split evenly between like more progressive and more conservative voters and potentially even trending more Republican?
I joke around that Florida was the best testing ground that I had in my foray into politics because Florida truly is a representation of our country. You know, you have Southern Florida, which is very, very diverse, a very Latino part of the state. And as you work your way north, it's like you're in the south of the country. So, you know, Northern Florida, Jacksonville is much more culturally south than a South Florida and a Miami. And then, of course, you have Central Florida, which is an enigma in and of itself because you have so many different communities truly meeting around the I-4 corridor. It truly is the representation of how diverse and different our country is. The reason why I think it swings so much is really a matter of resources and infrastructure. So every presidential cycle, Florida is on the map, and we see an influx of national organizations and national resources really coming into the state and making sure that no stone is left unturned when we're thinking about mobilizing our Democratic base. And that really runs through communities of color in Florida, means mobilizing the Black community, mobilizing the Latino community. And what happens and was really frustrating is that once those big presidential elections are over, the state is essentially left to fend for itself. So you get used to having everybody, all the cameras, all the celebrities, all of the organizations, all of the Democratic infrastructure really coming into the state right before a big presidential election. And then in the interim, folks have to figure out how to build infrastructure. And it's really confusing if you're an organizer on the ground because you get used to one way of doing things during a presidential cycle and have to really rebuild in the off years. And I've seen so much growth in the local party infrastructure and local organizing because folks are really focusing on recruiting leaders that are the ambassadors and they're the first people that engage with communities and not relying on national organizations or national money to do that infrastructure building. And so we're seeing a lot of change. And I'm very hopeful as we get to the final days that Florida truly is in play. And not just because of all of the investments that are happening at the national level, but because since 2016, folks in Florida have been working day and night to build a party that is diverse, that represents the state, and that is building from 2016 up until now to make sure that we turn out the vote in November.
There's nowhere more obvious on the importance of diversity, both within the ranks and in leadership in organizing than Florida because of the vast variety of cultural competencies that organizers need to have across the state to be able to really truly speak and engage to the different communities. So can you just help us understand like really where organizers truly need to understand the different communities?
When we're thinking about states, when we're thinking about voting blocks, we tend to paint everyone with broad strokes and say, this is a messaging for the Latino community. This is a messaging for the Black community. This is a messaging for suburban mothers. And I get it. That's just part of this work. But what is so beautiful about Florida and the lessons that we can learn from a state like Florida is that you have to be much more nuanced. With the Latino community, for instance, Latino Victory did an ad in 2018 where we shot the same ad, and the concept was, everyone knows that Latino families are run by the matriarchs. So we had an abuela in the kitchen making a meal, watching the news, and the question of healthcare came up. And depending on where in the state we were targeting different Republicans, and we said, you know, Governor Rick Scott is attempting to cut your health care, and Abuela got mad and she takes her slipper, which is a cultural marker that transcends ethnic background for the Latino community. She takes her chancla and she throws it at the TV and urges everyone to go out and vote in protection of health care and access to health care in the state. Now, what we did different is that in Miami, we knew it was very important to have an accent that was either Cuban or South American, because we know that the vast majority of Latinos in Miami are from South America or Caribbean, but a lot of them are Cuban. Whereas when we aired that ad in Central Florida, the accent was Puerto Rican. And when we did it in Tampa, again, different accent. And so just those cultural nuances are so important because they just show respect to a community. You have done enough research to know where I come from and to make me feel seen and represented. And again, the fundamental skill that you need to have as an organizer is just listening, and that goes such a long way.
And there's an interesting new kind of X factor in the electorate in Florida, potentially this cycle, which is the formerly incarcerated, because of the rights that were restored to them through Amendment 4 on the ballot in 2018, stripped by the state legislature, then went to court. Can you help us explain both the background here and also what kind of impact this could have on the electorate?
So Amendment 4 and the campaign for Amendment 4 is one of those great examples of how we build infrastructure and create a movement in those years in between presidential elections. And Amendment 4, for those of you who have not been following, was a campaign to pass this amendment, first to get it on the ballot and then to get the majority of voters to vote for it, which would restore the rights of formerly incarcerated individuals. And Florida is one of four states that does not allow formerly incarcerated individuals to participate in our electoral process. What was so significant about this campaign is that very often, you know, I talk about candidates and falling into the trap of like the cult of personality, where we build entire campaigns and build entire infrastructures based on a candidate. I am guilty of it. I, you know, got involved because of Obama. Many of us did. And what happened when Obama was no longer in office, folks that might have been in this work for him maybe no longer felt compelled to stay in this work. But when you bring it back to the issues, which is what Amendment 4 was about, you're able to build a more sustained organizing movement. And so Amendment 4 brought so many different people from all walks of life, from different party lines, working to make sure that folks that were formerly incarcerated had the right to vote. This campaign was so successful that it received 1 million more votes than Ron DeSantis, who became the governor of Florida. So Ron DeSantis garnered 4 million votes. Amendment 4, those who voted in favor of it, there were 5 million Floridians that did so. That's 1 million more votes than the governor. So Amendment 4, more popular than Ron DeSantis. Now, once it came to a question of implementation, Ron DeSantis introduced this legislation essentially saying that we're going to implement parts of Amendment 4, but in order for folks who were formerly incarcerated to be able to access their right to vote, they need to pay any fines that they might have outstanding, right? Because the premise of this amendment is that once you have completed your time, once you have served your sentence, you are able to regain your right to vote. And for many folks who have studied, you know, voter suppression, they were likening this fee to a poll tax, right? Like you're not allowing folks to just go vote. Folks are incurring fees that make it cost prohibitive for many people to be able to access the right to vote. So long story short, it's in court right now. And many folks who are following this case think that the Supreme Court in Florida, which has a ton of judges that Donald Trump appointed, they're going to push off this case until after November. And so it's so important to follow these things because we're seeing what happened to Amendment 4 or what is happening. And again, it's more popular than Ron DeSantis, and yet it is not being implemented because of all of the legal mix-ups right now that are waiting to be resolved in court.
So let's get into the logistics of how people are actually going to vote this year. So in Florida, anyone can request a mail-in ballot. Do you think that is enough? Are you worried about the hurricanes interfering with like voter registration efforts? Like, how do you plan in Florida around a hurricane season? And are people going to be able to vote?
Yeah. So in 2016, I was in Florida. I was the political director of the Florida Democratic Party. And I remember that we were a couple of days before the voter registration deadline in October. And everyone had to lock down in place because of a hurricane that was coming. And it obviously interfered with organizers and their metrics, but brought the question up to our local elected officials of what do you do in the case of a hurricane? Do you extend that voter registration deadline? And ultimately, lawyers on both sides of the aisle went to court, and we got some extra couple of days to be able to register voters. But that's a great point, especially in COVID-19 reality, where so much of the voter registration that gets done, and especially in communities of color, is in-person voter registration. I'm concerned that we're not able to make voter registration as accessible to people. I know that the Florida Democratic Party and a lot of the groups on the ground are doing a lot of amazing digital organizing work to make sure that folks can register to vote. But at the end of the day, even if you register to vote online, you have to print out the form, sign it, and then mail it back, which again is a huge obstacle for folks who may not have the time or resources to print something out and send it back. What is giving me a lot of hope and what I find encouraging, and I think that Florida, again, is a really great model for how to effectively implement a vote by mail process, is that the state has had vote by mail. And as you said, anyone can sign up to vote by mail. It's really easy. You go on the Supervisor of Elections website, you write your name, your address, you click a button, and that's it. You're registered to vote by mail. And they have it such that you can register to vote by mail for multiple elections. And it's been great to see how Florida and Florida Dems in particular have really been leading and sharing best practices on how to engage voters to vote by mail. There's a lot of doubt and questions about whether or not voting by mail really is the most secure option, which it is, folks. Vote by mail. Just make sure that you turn in your ballots early. And so again, Florida has been voting by mail forever. Local parties in the state Democratic Party has been doing this work of educating Democratic voters on how safe and secure voting by mail is, that they have registered 1 million voters this election cycle and now have an advantage over Republicans. So I do think that if you're in Florida, sign up to vote by mail and make sure that you submit your ballot early.
And for the listeners out of Florida, how can we help you?
At Latino Victory, as I mentioned, you know, one of the ways that we really believe in expanding access to democracy is by ensuring that we have candidates up and down the ballot who are really speaking directly to voters, because the likelihood of a voter getting to meet firsthand a presidential candidate is, you know, very slim. But you know who they will meet is their local school board member, city council member, candidates running to represent them directly in their homes. And one of those candidates that we love at Latino Victory is Congresswoman Debbie Mukerso Powell from Florida's 26th Congressional District. And she represents the swingiest of congressional districts in one of the swingiest states. And it is so important to make sure that folks are not just turning out to vote at the top of the ticket, but voting down ballot. And so if you want to help ensure that Democrats keep the House majority, you want to help ensure that Democrats win those 29 electoral votes, a huge chunk of those votes are coming from Miami. And you can do so by helping get Debbie Mukerso Powell reelected to Congress by visiting her website, which is debbiemukersopowell.com. She really, truly needs every ounce of support that is available, because she is running against the Republican county mayor who has been in office for a very long time in Miami. And so we want to make sure that we keep this trailblazing champion in Congress.
Thank you so much, Myra. It's been great having you on.
Thank you, Emily.
Okay, YPP listeners, we all know how important Florida is to this election, and it's going to take all of us to make sure the Democrats have a fighting chance in the state. If you want to weigh in on the swingiest swing district of the great swing states, then head to our Instagram at Your Presidential Playlist to figure out how best to support Congresswoman Debbie Mukerso Powell. Thank you for listening to this episode of Your Presidential Playlist. To get your action item, visit us on Instagram at Your Presidential Playlist. For more from Congresswoman Debbie Mercosell Powell, follow her on Twitter at RepDMP. For more from Myra, follow her on Twitter at LaChicaMyra. Special thanks to Wonder Media Network and the whole Your Presidential Playlist team for producing this show. Talk to you next time. For too long, history lessons have glossed over the truly essential contributions women have made to history. That's where Encyclopedia Womanica comes in. This podcast from Wonder Media Network aims to change the narrative by introducing the pioneers, scientists, artists, and more from antiquity to today who have shaped our society. Every weekday, host Jenny Kaplan dives into the trials, tragedy, and triumphs of this diverse group of groundbreaking women. And the best part is, each episode's only 5 minutes long. The bite-sized episodes pack painstakingly researched content into fun, entertaining, and addictive daily adventures. You may not already know these women, but you definitely should. Subscribe to Encyclopedia Womanica wherever you get podcasts.